preacher went home with them for dinner. And the boys had to wait. They peeping through a crack, watching them eat. They had chicken. And the chicken was fast disappearing. Finally, the father said to the pastor, "Will you have another portion of the chicken?" He said, "I believe we will." One of the boys said to the other one, said, "How much is a portion?" He said, "It's nearly all of it." So not much left for me after all these bones are put out. I said to the pastor, Brother Perdue, this morning, excusing my part on this program, I thought you'd had a great conference. I have fully enjoyed the songs, all of the messages, the fellowship, the food that's been served, the hospitality that's been shown, and what my heart has felt, what I have learned about our work in this great Northwest. I'm pleased with it. I know a lot of your pastors. The conference supposed will soon end. Then I will have to return home to your places for your services tomorrow. Probably not be with us after this service in this series. I'm glad to have been with you. I follow you in some of your bulletins and reports and have been rejoiced at the accomplishments you have wrought in this area. Long time ago, there was much criticism of the school in Little Rock. Old Brother G.D. Crawford, G.W. Crawford of Oklahoma, great man of influence in Oklahoma and in the ABA work early, had heard things against the school in Little Rock. He came down there and stayed 3 or 4 days. He sat in the classes. He was in the chapel. And the day that he was to leave, they held a chapel service, and he spoke. I was present. And here's what he said. Said, "I heard, I came, I've seen, and I believe." He didn't believe the reports had been made about the school. "Well, I've heard, and I came, and I've seen, and I've heard, and I believe in the great work you brethren are doing. May the Lord bless you," is my prayer. My work on Revelation was referred to this morning. I'm still riding that white horse. I knew when I took that position that I guess 9 and 9 out of 100 and maybe more than that disagreed with me, but I didn't care. Here's my position. If you don't agree with me, I don't agree with you. And we're equal. So you go your way and let me go mine. We won't fuss about it. But I'm still riding that horse. I won't argue about it. You remember I said in that book that I knew most of you wouldn't believe it. But if my thoughts introduced in that book would promote study of the Revelation, my purpose was accomplished. And I'm glad to learn that some of you have read it. Now to my subject. I don't know, it may be kind of a scattergun, but I'm going to do my best. No? About my best. Somebody said nobody did his best. Baptist in America. The first permanent settlement in the United States was by the Spaniards at St. Augustine, Florida, in 1687, I believe. 1587. The Pilgrims landed at Plymouth in 1620. They began to settle in this country. The Pilgrims, called Puritans, were Congregationalists. They believed in sprinkling for baptism. They had fled England to avoid persecution because of their religious belief by the established religion of England. They came over into this country, tied church and state together, and practiced the same thing in the colonies that they had fled from in England. There was about 10 years or 11 years passed before there was any man of a Baptist sentiment recognized in any of the colonies. Roger Williams was trained in England, a very brilliant man, a contender for religious liberty, a Congregationalist in religion, came to America, but he had some Baptist sentiments. He had been acquainted with the Baptists in England. He became pastor of the church in Salem, Massachusetts. His preaching religious liberty was in violation of the established principles and rules of government of the colony, and he fell into ill repute with them. He was chased out of the pastorate of the church, banished out of the colony in the cold of winter, but he had been there long enough to have made friends with the Indians of two or three different tribes, had learned their language. By their care, his life was preserved through a frightful winter. Finally, landed in what now Rhode Island, secured some territory from the Indians, few followers, he wanted to organize a church. None of them had been baptized. And he wanted to organize a church that's now called the First Baptist Church in America, but I don't believe that. He had a man named Ezekiel Holloman, or Holman, to baptize him. After he had baptized, he turned around and baptized 10 others. So 11 of them went into an organization that's called a church. And he came to this country in 1631. In 1637, John Clark came from England. John Clark was an ordained Baptist minister and a practicing physician. He came to Massachusetts with his followers and went to Salem. There the Anne Hutchinson controversy was raging, and there was in a fuss in Massachusetts. Religiously, and he didn't want to stay there, so he moved up into what's now New Hampshire. The weather was so cold, and they suffered so much from it, they moved south, went down by what's Providence, talked to Roger Williams, moved on south, acquired an island, I believe the name of Aqueduct, and there established a small community of people. In 1638, most historians say in 1644, John Clark organized a church and became pastor of it. Now, for just a little bit of time, I don't spend much time on this. The argument is as to which is the older, the church established by Roger Williams or the church established by John Clark. We recognize the church of John Clark was scriptural. He had scriptural baptism. Roger Williams and his followers did not have scriptural baptism. I don't believe it was even a scriptural church to start with. So, Williams didn't stay with it very long. He quit it. And I think that it about went into dissolution. But probably the church in Providence, Rhode Island, was scripturally organized in 1651. I've been to both of these churches. I've been to the church in Providence two different times. I was there in 1939, and I was back there in 1965. And on the trip in 1965, I visited the church in Newport. If any of you have seen the republished edition of the First Baptist Church in America, I was asked to write an addenda to that. And several pages, 30, 40 pages in the back of that book's my work on what I found in Providence and Newport. J.R. Graves had gone to Providence in his lifetime to investigate the thing. And in his book, he has a reproduction of the cornerstone or the plaque that gave the date of the organization of that church in 1639, that first thing that Roger Williams started. I was there with a camera in 1939, and I took a picture of the cornerstone, and it said 1638. Well, Graves' cornerstone and Graves was there was 1639. When I was there, it was 1638. Evidently, that thing was changed because of the established fact that the church in Newport was organized the year before. And that's been a contention amongst them always, still is. My wife and daughter and I drove up to the church in Newport, went in, the pastor's secretary was there, and I never was treated more kindly anywhere. The pastor was out for a time, and she called him, she knew where he was, and I wanted her to take me to Clark's grave. And she called her pastor, and he gave consent. That woman got in the car and drove my car to the grave of John Clark, and I took some pictures in the graveyard of his grave. I believe that the church in Newport was the first real Baptist church in America. I would not give any discredit to Roger Williams. He was a Baptist in sentiment, I think. And he lived and died out of a church. His conclusion was that somewhere down the line that the church had ceased to exist, that the original authority vested in it by the Lord Himself to baptize was lost. He said the baptism of Clark came near being that that he thought was scriptural than any he had ever known. But he did not accept it. Roger Williams was one of the greatest of Americans, one of the early and great contenders for religious liberty for all peoples, and established his colony on that belief. A little later on, Roger Williams and John Clark both were sent to England. While Clark was in England, Obadiah Holmes pastored the church in his stead. Their purpose in going to England was to secure a charter for the Rhode Island colony. Roger Williams didn't stay too long. John Clark stayed for 12 years. During that 12 years, he had to battle the persecution of the Baptists in England. Charles II was one of the persecutors. The Lord undoubtedly was in it. But he finally obtained a charter from Charles II of England to establish the colony of Rhode Island, chartered as being free and independent from the other colonies insofar as their religious devotion was concerned. And the Rhode Island colony was the first government ever set up on earth that had a law guaranteeing religious liberty to all people. So John Clark and Roger Williams wrought great in that field. During the time of Clark's life and ministry, in Salem there was an old brother named Witter, W-I-T-T-E-R, William Witter. And he had become familiar with the Baptist teachings. He had a child born. They believed in infant baptism. He refused to let them baptize his child, his baby. They put him in jail. And he spent a long time in jail. And John Clark and John Crandall and Obadiah Holmes left Newport, went to Salem, Massachusetts, to encourage and sympathize with old Brother Witter. Had been jailed for refusing infant baptism by the established church. While they were there, they got arrested for holding service without a license and away from the church, and they were all jailed. Make a long story short, none of them wanted to be bonded out or bailed out of the jail. But finally, Crandall and Clark were bailed out. But Obadiah Holmes would not receive the bail. And he is the first Baptist in America that was whipped at the whipping post. They beat him nearly to death. He wasn't able to lie on his back for 3 months after that. So persecution by churches, so-called, of Baptists in America, begun very early. And that persecution continued for about 150 years. So I'm going to leave that. They had these churches there. And move on down in my thoughts to Virginia. The Baptists in Virginia, and I won't have time this morning, but tomorrow I want to deal with the Baptists in Pennsylvania and other places. In the year 1706 in England, the Virginia colony, the territory had been obtained, but had not been settled by any except the natives, the Indians. In England, there was a charter drawn up for the purpose of establishing the Virginia colony based on the Episcopal religion. And it provided that anyone who would entice any member of the establishment or any of the subjects within it, that meant the Indians, out of their religious beliefs into something else, would be arrested and jailed and tried. And as a final result, sent to England, there to receive condign punishment for their violation of the charter of the colony. That ruled all out of Virginia except the Episcopals. At this time, a little later on, when the Baptists had begun pretty well established in New England, John Whitefield came over here. John Whitefield was a contemporary with the Wesleys, Charles and John Wesley. He helped establish the Methodist societies in the Episcopal Church in England. But Whitefield got bit by the Calvinistic bug, and he separated from the Wesleys and established the Calvinistic Methodist societies. So he was a very brilliant man, a very great orator, and a very influential fellow from the platform that came over to this country, was well received by the people, and it divided the Baptists. That's where Calvinism got planted in this country, was mainly in the beginning through George Whitefield. And the Baptists were separated in what they call the regulars and the separate Baptists. They remained separated for quite a long, long time. So the separate Baptists dared to move into the Virginia Territory and to preach. And they began to arrest and jail them. And in they jailed many of them. But I'm going to name particularly three or four. These that were put in jail were Elijah Craig, John Waller, James Child, a lesser influential man named Nash, and there was another one that I don't remember his name right now. They were put in jail, tried once, and they were going to be tried again. Patrick Henry at that time had come into prominence, and he had defended some Baptists in one court, and he heard of this second trial of the three men, Craig, Waller, and Childs, and he was innocent enough in religious liberty. You know, he became famous by that statement when he said, with reference to the tyranny of England, "Give me liberty or give me death." He was a contender for liberty. Here were these Baptist preachers in jail because they had preached the gospel in the territory where it was forbidden for them to do it. So he volunteered his services to defend these Baptist preachers. The book out of which I copied Patrick Henry's address is titled "Imprisoned Preachers and Baptist Liberty in America." And I don't know but one book anywhere under that title. J.M. Holliday of West Virginia has the book. I spent 3 weeks in West Virginia and lectured in a school over there, those independent Baptists. J. Jay Holiday was on in my group on a trip to the Holy Land, and I knew him well, and he was so attached to that book he wouldn't hardly take it out of his room in the dormitory over to mine. But I got over there and read some of it, and I saw it was so unusual and important. I had some tapes in my bag, but I didn't have a recorder. So I read that book and marked a lot of pages, borrowed a recorder and took a tape, got off in a room to myself, and I recorded about almost an hour's reading out of that book. And in what I read, I found what I had never seen, a purported speech that Patrick Henry delivered in defense of these three Baptist preachers. So I brought that tape with me, and I arranged with Brother Perdue to play Patrick Henry's speech in defense of these three Baptist preachers for your benefit. And if you'll now give attention, I'll desist until this is played off on the tape recorder.
Patrick Henry, who had a few years before brought himself into notice by his famous plea against the parsons in Hanover, hearing of the situation of these Baptists confined in Spotsylvania jail, rode some 50 miles to volunteer his services on the day of their second trial. He entered the courthouse almost entirely unknown. While the indictment was reading by the clerk, the king's attorney, having made some remarks in defense of the prosecution, Mr. Henry, taking the paper concerning the indictment, said, "May it please your worships, I think I heard read by the prosecutor as I entered the house the paper I now hold in my hand. If I rightly understood, the king's attorney has framed an indictment for the purpose of arraigning and punishing by imprisonment these three inoffensive persons before the bar of this court for a crime of great magnitude as disturbers of the peace. May it please the court, what did I hear read? Did I hear it distinctly, or was it a mistake of my own? Did I hear an expression as of a crime that these men, whom your worships are about to try for a misdemeanor, are charged with what?" Then in a low, solemn, heavy tone, he continued, preaching the gospel of the Son of God. Pausing amid profound silence, he waved the paper three times around his head, then raising his eyes and hands to heaven with a peculiar and impressive energy, he exclaimed, "Great God!" A burst of feeling from the audience followed this explanation. Mr. Henry resumed, "May it please your worships, in a day like this, when truth is about to burst her fetters, when mankind is about to be aroused to claim their natural and inalienable rights, when the yoke of oppression that has reached the wilderness of America and the unnatural alliance of ecclesiastical and civil power are about to be dissevered, at such a period when liberty of conscience is about to wake from her slumberings and inquire into the reason such charges as I find exhibited here today in this indictment, here he falls, and Algernon cast his piercing eyes upon the court and upon the prisoners and resumed, if I'm not deceived, according to the contents of the paper I now hold in my hand, these men are accused of preaching the gospel of the Son of God, great God." A deeper impression was visible as he paused and slowly waved the paper around his head. "May it please your worships, there are periods in the history of man when corruption and depravity have so long debased the human character that man sinks under the weight of the oppressor's hand becomes his servile, his abject slave. He licks the hand that smites him. And this state of servility, he receives his fetters of perpetual bondage. But may it please your worship, such a day has passed away. From that period when our fathers left the land of their nativity for these American wilds, from the moment they placed their feet upon the American continent, from that moment despotism was crushed. The fetters of darkness were broken, and heaven decreed that man should be free. Free to worship God according to the Bible. Were it not for this, in vain were all the sufferings and bloodshed to subjugate this new world. If we, their offspring, must still be oppressed and persecuted, but may it please your worship, permit me to inquire once more, for what are these men about to be tried? This paper says, for preaching the gospel of the Savior to Adam's fallen race. For the third time, he waved the indictment around his head, lifting his eyes to heaven in a solemn, dignified manner, and again looking at the court, he explained with the full power of his strong voice, what law have they violated? The scene now became painful. The audience were excited. The attorney was agitated. The bench and bar were moved. And the presiding magistrate exclaimed, Sheriff, discharge these men.
Thank you, Brother Perdue. I don't know whether that's genuine or not. That was purported to be the speech that Roger Williams delivered. In 1760, there was not a Baptist church in Virginia. And in 1790, in 30 years, there were 200 Baptist churches in Virginia. During the same time, there was an increase in the Baptist churches in New York of 165. At this time, one out of every eight citizens in the American colonies was identified with the Baptists. The matter of religious liberty has, from the time of Christ, the establishment of the first church, been a struggle of Baptists. Always they've been bound or hindered, persecuted, for wanting to worship God according to the dictates of their own conscience, without any legal or ecclesiastical law to bind or govern them. And the struggle for religious liberty in Virginia is outstanding by the Baptists. And in that great struggle, the Baptists were outstanding leaders. And it said, but the growth of the Baptists, in spite of the opposition to them, I read where one fellow said that while Washington and his military forces were putting to riot and destroying the emissaries and the redcoats of England, that separate Baptist is doing the same thing to the Episcopalians in Virginia. So the Baptist begun to be recognized in great influence. Thomas Jefferson, Patrick Henry, and James Madison all lived in Virginia. Well, Jefferson and Madison both later became president of the country, and Patrick Henry became famous as a lawyer. Neither one of these people were a Baptist. But Jefferson was a friend of some Baptist people and lived not very far from a Baptist church, and he sometimes attended it. He was a very close friend of John Leland. Well, John Leland was equal in intelligence as a Baptist minister to James Madison or Jefferson or any of the others. He was a giant. He was a contender for religious liberty. By 1768 or 9, the Baptists in Virginia had organized a convention, association. And the main effort of that group was to obtain religious liberty. And lest I wouldn't think of it tomorrow, I'm going to mention it now, and I'm going to quit in about 2 minutes. When the Revolutionary War broke out, as the Baptists had thought they might gain religious liberty in England by joining the military forces of Oliver Cromwell, their hope of religious liberty was to be freed from the tyranny of King George and his influence over the colonies in this country. And the Baptists were the most patriotic, perhaps, of any organization or any group of people in America. So many, many, many of them enlisted in the Revolutionary Army under George Washington. There are instances on record where they would meet to worship, and all of the men of military strength would leave the church and go into the army. There are 23 known and named chaplains in Washington's army. And 6 of these were named as Baptists. And Washington said, of all of the chaplains in the army, that the Baptists were the most useful and the most influential of any and all of them. I don't remember the names of all of the 6, but I do remember the names of some of them. Elijah Craig, John Waller, and John Gaino, and John Leland. The 2 others' name right now, I don't remember. But the Baptist struggle for religious liberty has been as great an effort to obtain as it has been through all of the world to speak out and labor against false baptisms and those other things that they deemed heretical. So tomorrow I'm going further into this. I'm not going into this religious liberty thing any further today, because I wouldn't have time to develop it, and I want to develop it as to how that thing developed in Virginia through Henry and Madison and Leland and in New England, Isaac Backus. And I believe that I'll be able to establish to your consideration the definite fact that the First Amendment to the Constitution is there because of Baptists. And I do have the historical background about how it was all brought to pass. So tonight, I said tomorrow, I believe, but tonight, I'll wind up my efforts, and I'll have so much to say, I can't say much. But I want to deal particularly with the gaining of religious liberty, the spread of our work, the organization and influence of the associations, and I've tried to trace the Baptists from England and Wales through the associations. As the frontier moved westward, the Baptists moved with it. And I'm going to buy these books on Oregon. I'm not familiar with that, but I know how the Baptists came into Arkansas and they came into all the other states the same way. So that'll be my effort tonight. I hope I've been able to suggest something in these efforts. It's helpful. And I'll do my best to continue it and finish it in a hurried manner in the service this evening. Thank you. And God bless you. And I'll turn the service now to the presiding officer.
Get you unhooked here. My, what a price has been paid for the freedom that we have in America. We ought to be thankful and proud, and most proud, to Jesus Christ our Savior for all of this. I know that you are. I am, and I'm sure that each of you are also. Brother Glover and Brother Powers have been the featured speakers as far as the week is concerned, but Brother Eisenhower, Brother Bean, and also Brother Campbell have, I think, brought excellent messages as well. I've enjoyed it immensely. We want you to know, I want you to know, that we thank you for coming and being in our services and blessing us with these great sermons that you brought. May